This is an oral history recording at Westminster School on the 9th of March 2016 with Elizabeth Wells, archivist, and
John Croft of Westminster.
To begin with, would you mind telling us a little bit about your family background, your parents, where you grew up?
My father was a film renter who had seen active service between the Allied and enemy lines in France in the First Great War. And he was tapping German lines, telephone lines. And my mother, like all, she didn't have a job in those days until the war came, when she did. But I would say they were of sort of middle-class background and sacrificed a lot to send me to Westminster.
Where did you live growing up?
I'm a Londoner. When I first went to the school, I must have been in St. John's Wood, I think. Most of my school life, until the war interrupted absolutely everything, of course, was just off Baker Street. So London was the answer to that.
Did you go to a prep school?
Yes, I went to the Hall, Hampstead. In fact, in that envelope, there's a letter from the headmaster of the Hall, Hampstead. I think more in connection, maybe. We'll have a look at that later, perhaps. Am I speaking clearly enough?
I'm sure you are. I can understand you.
Yes, but can it?
Yes. No, it's definitely picking you up. And at what point was the decision made to go to Westminster?
I sat for whatever it was at St. Paul's, because my uncle, who was a barrister, that's my mother's brother, had been there. And I sat for Westminster. Nothing else. So it was either St. Paul's or Westminster. I don't know who made the choice. Possibly, I don't think I did. My parents must have decided on Westminster. And all the paraphernalia in those days that went with it, top hat and all the rest of it.
Do you remember going to buy the top hat?
Oh, yes, I do. I can't remember where from. There must have been one particular supplier. The name that comes to my mind is, of course, not there now, but somewhere at the top of Bond Street. Was it Row?
I don't know. Yes, I know. I don't know the suppliers at that point. We used somebody on Broadway for a while. But I think that was more near St. James's Park, but I think it was more for the sort of ties and the sport kit rather than the top hat and tails.
I don't think there'd be a clue on this, no.
And was your first time at the school your first day? Had you come for the exam, or was the exam at the hall, your prep school?
I don't know the answer to that. I think it must have been here, because I certainly went to St. Paul's for an exam, so I must have come here for an exam. I don't think they would have done it at the prep school, because you have to gather sufficient numbers together for the purpose.
Can you remember your first impressions of coming here and the buildings?
Yes, because when I arrived, my father brought me to the archway. A boy was waiting for me, and he said, let me get this right. The system was, he looked after me for a couple of weeks to see that I didn't get any trouble. If I did, it was his fault. And there was substance and shadow. Now, he must have been the shadow, I must have been the substance, or could have been the other way around.
I think it's the other way around, yes.
Right. It still goes on, does it?
No, it doesn't, but I have heard about it many times before.
Oh, have you?
Yes.
That was the first impression. I then I was asked to, by a man called Thornton Lofthouse, who was the organist of the Abbey, and he said, can you sing? So I said, well, I play the piano and I'm musical. I was musical, actually. He said, he tried me out on a few notes. He says, you can't sing. I've never forgiven him for that. You should never tell anybody at the age of 13 or at any age you can't do this. However, it's long past.
And was your substance a good substance? Did he show you the ropes?
Yes. I don't think it's... Well, none of my contemporaries are alive now from the school or that I was friendly with. His name was Boyes, I think, curiously enough. B-O-Y-E-S.
And he showed you the ropes?
Such ropes as there were, yes, because the school was much smaller then.
And you were in Home Boarders House?
Home Boarders, yes.
Which is now number 19, or 18 and 17, Dean's Yard, I think we refer to it. What were the facilities like for you as a pupil in there? Was it one big room, or...?
It was divided into three rooms, really. I forget all the exact names. The under, I think, the middle, and the upper, probably. It was something like that. So one started off on the lowest level, which would have contained about 20 boys, perhaps not as many, with a locker. The housemaster was a man called Major Troutbeck. Never heard of him?
Yes, I have.
He was a pleasant enough man, ex-army, of course. Well, he'd served, well, so many people had served in the war at that point. We're talking about 1936.
Were you very aware of what people had done in the war? You spoke about your father's military service.
He would never talk about it, and very few people of that generation did. Much later in life, towards the end of his life, I got him to say something to the Imperial War Museum, but it wasn't a very successful interview because they asked the wrong questions.
That's made me rather nervous. And you were in Home Boarders, so you were a day pupil.
Yeah, that's right.
Was that clear from the outset that you would be a day pupil? I suppose you lived rather close to the school, so...
Yes, there was no issue about boarding or half boarding or whatever. There were some boys, of course, we had boarding during the week and went over the weekend. No, I was... day people entirely.
What was your journey like from St John's Wood to the school?
Bus. I did my homework on the bus going back, so I hardly ever took anything home.
It's rather convenient. Good use of the commute.
Yeah.
And did you feel there was a distinction between the boarders and the day boys? Did you feel a proper part of the school?
Not particularly, no. I think See, there were 365 boys, I was supposed to be, about that time. And it was a community spirit, enhanced by our chapel, which, of course, was Westminster Abbey, which was a wonderful experience. I've never forgotten that. And Latin prayers, twice a week, I think, in the late afternoon. And we were mixed with other people in the classroom, of course, who were boarders as well. So I don't think there was a sense of separateness.
And when you were here, there would have been services in the Abbey for you every day?
Yes. We started off in the morning. Mm-hmm. And a friend of mine at prep school, in fact, was a King Scholar, but a day boy too at Ashburnham. We used to walk round the cloisters, being careful not to step on certain stones, which was forbidden. And, yes, it was every day.
What did a typical service consist of? Was there a sermon every day? Or just a mixture of hymns and readings?
Hymns and prayers and readings. Sometimes, but very rarely, I think, the headmaster might have had something to say and he said it. But I had two headmasters. The first one was Costley White, who later became dean of, well, you know all this, presumably. Worcester, was it?
Yes, that's right. Mm.
He was a very nice man. He invited all the new boys, my batch, anyway, to have tea in the headmaster's house on the dean's yard. He showed us round the house and funny old sort of cubby holes and things that there were. Then, of course, after a year or two, he was succeeded by John Christie, who was rather different. I got to know him very well, actually, much later. But that's not the matter.
So what was the initial transition like between those two figures, between Costley White?
Well, I wasn't terribly conscious of it. Myself, because I didn't get in the way, so to speak, but people who got in the way were rather conscious of it. He was a much more disciplinarian character at that point. Costley White, I think, was fairly easygoing, whatever that may mean.
Can I ask you some more mundane questions too? Because I'm always interested in things like, where did you have your lunch? Was that
in Hall, which another. I think I was very conscious of it, that these are beautiful buildings, both up school, of course, which has gone, and the hall, which hasn't. And yes, it was a kind of introduction to living in, or frequenting ancient structures, really. And I talked to other boys. One of my closest friends at lunchtime was the elder Wedgwood Benn, not the little Wedgwood Benn.
And what was
he was known.
And what was the food like?
Oh, I seem to remember it being quite edible, yes. I think it was. That's a difficult question. yes, it was quite good, I think, on the whole.
Did you buy snacks at break time? Was there a tuck shop?
There was a tuck shop. I didn't much go in for that, but occasionally did. Yes, the sort of chocolate things, I suppose. But I didn't go in for that sort of thing very much.
What sort of things went on during the break times and the lunch time when you were free from lessons?
Nothing very much, because the breaks weren't very long. I don't recall anything particular. Interesting question. We used to sometimes walk round the little cloister, which was very beautiful and of course was bombed partly. No, I don't remember anything particular. A few things in the house, I don't know what they would have been particularly. Well, of course, for the prefects, they were called monitors, weren't they? One had to collect their books and things and bring them down, so that would take up a little time, perhaps.
Was that a version of fagging then?
It was, actually, yes. That's the last remnant of something of that kind, I think.
You mentioned that Costley was a bit more relaxed. Was there a strict sense of discipline, though, within the house, a hierarchy?
No, not particularly. No, I think it was fairly easygoing, as I look back on it.
Was there still much corporal punishment taking place?
There was some, and I wasn't involved. not a lot, I don't think, probably compared with some schools from what I've heard, places like rugby and so forth. Which my parents originally, you know, that you had to put boys and possibly some girls in some cases who want to go to Cheltenham Ladies' College. Well, them had to be put down very early. My name was put down for rugby. Thank goodness I escaped all that.
You've mentioned some of the masters that you recall, but I was wondering whether any others particularly stood out in your mind.
Oh, indeed. The first art master, who was very old fashioned, I suppose, said, "You can't paint," which is not something one should say to anybody. He left and was succeeded by a man called Wentworth Shields. And he said, "Well, just do what you like." So I did what I liked. And he said, "Well, that's okay, and perhaps here, one, two things." He was completely reverse. I learned a lot from him. And I remember all the masters. There's a man called Wordsworth, who was a descendant of Wordsworth. I'm just trying to remember. Franklin was took me through school certificate. He was a chaplain. We could divert him a little bit from the subject by asking him how he enjoyed rowing at Oxford, because he was in the Oxford boat which sank in 1920s somewhere. So these sort of people I remember. The classes were small. John Carlton took history. Of course, he became headmaster after Christie, I think I'm right in saying. So I do remember the masters with... when the war came and the evacuation, the school got even smaller, so one was in closer contact with the masters, in a way.
Yes. So when you started, you initially went through a series of classes that led up to doing your school certificate.
Mm.
Did you sit that fairly early on?
Well, the stock age, I think, the standard age, it was a removed form. The classroom was just off the tiny, small classroom off Harp School on the left. The question was?
Wasn't a very well-phrased question, but I was wondering really what the structure of your timetable was like at the beginning.
I don't think it was anything different from a normal school day.
You didn't have to specialise early on?
No, there was no specialisation. The only specialisation that I'm tracking back a bit, which happened right when I arrived, there were two sides. The classical side and the, what's it called, the modern side. And I had wanted to become a doctor, actually, when I was about 12. But when I got to the school here, they said, right, classical side, because I'd done Greek and Latin and all that sort of thing. And it didn't sort of occur to me that one was going down one path and not another. Well, it was much too early at that sort of age, 13, 14, I think, to really know. Later in life, I met two old Westminsters, both of whom being on the classical side, and crossed over into medicine, which is very difficult today to do that today, but it's not so rigid as it was then.
Mm-hmm.
So some subjects like biology, for instance, didn't get near. There was a bit of teaching of elementary science, but I don't know that that was very up to date, because we didn't do experiments ourselves or anything. And that seemed to disappear after the first year or two. I think as it came up to school certificate, it must have got much more specialised. The classic Latin and Greek, maths, which must have been taught separately, history, not much else. English. I learnt an entire Shakespeare play by heart. Not one of his better ones either, I may add.
Did you get to perform any plays?
No, not at that point. No, not near it. More of that sort of thing happened in with the evacuated school, actually.
I wanted to ask you a few more questions prior to the evacuation. The first set of questions I'd like to ask is really about events going on outside of the school and how much within school life you were aware of them.
Well, we were aware of them because we were very close to them. And I do remember all the fuss about Edward VIII's abdication. Remember that? There were great crowds of people in Parliament Square and so on. We used to go out. Well, I know where it is exactly, but how we got there, not sure. Next to Henry VII's chapel, there was a green space, and we stood there, I suppose, practically the whole school, for the state opening of Parliament, so one, two things of that kind, which I was conscious of. Dean's Yard was full of gaiters and curious hats in convocation time. So one was aware of what we'd call it, Westminster life, I suppose. If you're asking of things beyond that, well, yes, because I went abroad with my parents for holidays, and to Switzerland mostly in those days, or Austria, and we were aware of Nazi Germany and all that sort of thing. So, does that answer your question? Not sure.
Yes, partly.
Partly.
Were these things talked about at school? Do you remember speakers coming in?
The Spanish Civil War, I don't think was talked about particularly, but it must have been talked about at home and various places. I find that difficult to recall because, you know, I've sort of read so much history since that it's part of me. So, as a schoolboy, I doubt if the Spanish Civil War was much on our minds.
One of the things we often read about is the fact that the German ambassador, von Ribbentrop's son, was at Westminster School at this time. Do you remember him?
Oh, I do. So he's still alive, by the way.
He is,
I
yes.
thought so. Yes, he would have been, I'm 93, he must be now 94, 5. Yes, I remember all that. His arrival and so on, and my father, who had access to Paramount, he worked for Paramount Films, and they sent somebody down here to film his arrival at the school and all the rest of it. And unfortunately, the tape of that, or whatever you call it, which I had, was lost in the fire because all our belongings, we were bombed out, and all our belongings were eventually destroyed. So that's another story. No, well, he was here for, what, a year or two? He was a very good athlete. That's all I remember of him particularly.
Did it cause a stir within the school, do you think?
I think it did slightly. He was in Home Borders. But he was quite a pleasant young man, if I can say that. I think so. He became a major general during the war, I believe. All this is documented by you.
And do you remember the coronation in 1937?
Not very clearly. That's throwing me back a bit. I must have seen the procession at some time. The one or two things I do remember of that kind, like George V's funeral, for instance, which I saw from near Paddington. The coronation I don't remember spectacularly. George V's jubilee, remember that? No, that I wouldn't have been at school then.
No, and maybe when the King and Queen came to see the Latin play.
Yes, I remember that event. I wasn't present on that occasion. Or was I? I don't know, because we were sort of pushed into the back of college, upstairs, and told when to clap and all that sort of thing. My father came to one of the performances, but that wasn't the one which the King and Queen were present at. Although I've seen pictures, I don't think this is a personal remembrance of their presence.
And I was going to ask about some of the other sort of major school traditions. Do you have strong memories of the Grease?
Yes, I do remember that. Didn't take part in it, but I witnessed it and all the rest of it. It was a bit uncivilised.
Now, one of the things I learnt about fairly recently is that the school evacuated rather prematurely in 1938.
It did.
Down to Lancing College for a week. And I was wondering if you had memories of that event.
I don't remember going with that. by the way, onto that thing, the other thing which began to loom larger in school life was the OTC.
Hmm.
And I remember all that. We used to have a shooting range against the Westminster, the south wall of Westminster Abbey, which seemed rather peculiar. And we were inspected as a corps, I suppose. I think practically everybody was in it. There were very few exceptions. We were inspected by some old general or something once a year. But that loomed larger, of course. But I don't think in 1938 I went with that first evacuation. The second one in 39, I must have done, for a bit. And then I didn't accustom myself very well, I suppose, to the... We were first evacuated to Shoreham. Whether that was in 38, I don't know. Certainly in 39. And housed in part of the Shoreham Grammar School. And then there was a break in my Westminster education, not in my sort of private education. I came back because part of the 1940s I seemed to be in London, early 1940 itself. Mm. So there were slight breaks there, which I don't think were correctly recorded in the school archive as it then was. Because in the record of Old Westminster, I don't think it's right.
No, in the record it says that you left in July 1939 and then came back again in May of 1940. I don't know whether that's accurate or not.
It's probably roughly right, because I went to keep my education going, to Crammers, I suppose you would call it. Which laid some of the foundations for my interest in history, actually. So, yes, I think that was probably approximately right.
Mm.
And when I went back, the school, we're talking about 1940, would still have been at Shoreham.
Yes.
And I was billeted out, which I much preferred, rather than being a sort of boarder in a house. And then, of course, there was the evacuation to Exeter University, which was in the summer, I think, of late summer of 40. And that was very pleasant indeed. And I enjoyed that. And then I was living in students' buildings and so on. And then eventually, I missed something out. Well, Lansing was before Exeter, of course. At Lansing, the teaching was at Lansing. Obviously, the Lansing school itself was there. But we used to have our morning services there. And the very nice chaplain, I said to him, you know, I'd rather like to learn the organ. He gave me organ lessons. He was a very tall, gaunt man, known as the Holy Ghost. He was a very nice man indeed, so I learned to play the organ a bit. And when we went to Exeter, I continued to play the organ in the local church for myself and a friend of mine. And I remember vividly, when you're, what would that have been, 16, I suppose, you pull out all the stops. And the door opened, and the vicar put his head round. He said, "Would you mind not playing quite so loudly? The church might fall down." You know, things like that that stick in one's mind. And then, of course, there was the evacuation to Bromyard, where the school really was very split up. A change of, I was by then, I suppose, in the history, 7th or whatever it was, John Bowell, who had taught not very effectively at Lansing. And then he widened one's cultural horizon, I'll give him that. It was Winston Monk who really got me through, trained me up for a scholarship, I think, looking back on it. I got a Christchurch, and there was no point in staying on at the school. So in January 1941, I went off to Christchurch.
To read history?
Yes.
And you mentioned it beginning to stand out for you as a subject at your crammar.
Yes, it did. I suppose that steered me into the history of 6th, or whatever it was, with John Bowell sort of leading it. We didn't do much else, I don't think. You see, all my contemporaries, Richard Walholm became a professor of philosophy, Patrick Gardner became a philosopher fellow of Magdalen eventually, Mike Flanders. We talked. Mostly. I don't think we learnt over much.
You mentioned Mike Flanders. Do you remember seeing the show that he put on? I think it was called Go To It, when you were down in Exeter.
I don't remember that in Exeter. I remember him doing things in Oxford because we were immediate contemporaries there. And, well, Donald Swan, of course. So there was a whole group that moved from Westminster into Christchurch in those days. So, I don't remember anything in Exeter particularly.
The other person I was going to ask you who might have been part of that circle was Hugh Lloyd-Jones.
Yes, I remember him. He was older than me. Peter Ustinov, Hugh Lloyd-Jones, they're all slightly, as you realise, a year makes an enormous difference in that time of life. But I did know them slightly, didn't I? I can't think who else. Oh yes, Peter Brook.
Was it a big change when you effectively became a boarder? Was it a very different school experience for you?
Well, it was a rather different in a sense, because I hadn't how can I describe it? It was the conditions of war. Going out and singing carols in a terribly cold night, snow on the ground, seeing the, you could just see the flames from the bombing of Birmingham on the horizon. Things of that description. And it was bitterly cold, the winter of 40, 41, that would have been. Well, it was quite a different experience, really.
Were you associated with a different house?
No.
One of the boarding houses?
A man called Young was a housemaster. It was the same house, it was still called Home Boarders. I and another, what does one say, somebody called Blackburn, name wouldn't ring a bell. He and I, we put on a show, not as good as Mark Flanders probably, but still the headmaster came, that was Christie, and it was quite a good audience, and so a few amateur dramatics.
And the school, when you came out to Bromyard, was very, as you said, very dispersed. Did that make life difficult?
Well, it meant the school never came together as a school. There might have been one service in Bromyard Church, which I vaguely remember, but otherwise there was no place of what you might call where we could all congregate. It was very scattered. And the masters were scattered. Some of them lived in a large house where I had sort of... I was invited to tea, I suppose. There were sort of semi-tutorials, I think, as I look back on it. So it was a very scattered thing. And once having got into Christchurch, as it were, I thought there was no point in staying, so I went.
What are your memories of John Christie from this time as headmaster of this rather odd setup?
Well, my memories of John Christie are so much coloured by my later acquaintance, because when he was principal of Jesus, I went and had lunch. He was my seconder for the Athenaeum when I was a member of the Athenaeum. And so we saw each other on a totally different relationship. No, he used to come... he came and took some Latin classes. That I do recall. He came down to the school, but that would have been not possibly once a week, but I doubt if it was as much as that. Everything was so scattered. I mean, it was very difficult for him to move around and get to know everybody. It was amazing, in a sense, that the school survived, I think, when I look back on it. But it did. And the top hats and tails disappeared with it.
Yes, was it a relief when you were evacuated that you could set aside that formal... uniform?
Well, I got so used to the formal uniform that it didn't really make much odds, I don't think.
Now, whilst you were away with the school, I wondered if you'd tell me what your parents were doing during the war.
My father still worked for Paramount because he was well beyond call-up age or anything else. I think he did some fire watching and so forth. My mother worked at the ophthalmic hospital on the Marylebone Road. So they were both away, as it were, but then we were bombed out of our flat and we had to live in temporary premises and so on. So it was an all great disruption.
So your home was bombed and you were in temporary accommodation, the family were moved to temporary
accommodation. We had a flat in Baker Street. We were 1940 sitting in it. And I have a vivid memory of a bomb coming down, hitting the end of the block, which made our own place completely uninhabitable. So we moved out, and all our belongings were moved out into Druce's, I think it was, the store, and that was burnt down, so hardly anything of mine, or of my parents for that matter, survived the war.
And when you went to Christchurch, you weren't there for very long before you joined.
Well, I got four terms in. And I was in the senior training corps and all that sort of business, reading history. Do you want more of all that?
Yes. Did it feel like a very natural progression from school? You mentioned a circle of people coming
yes,
from Westminster.
Yes, it did in many ways, but different. Again, Christchurch Chapel was a cathedral. Not quite as handsome as Westminster Abbey, but still. What else? Yes, it was taken up with military training, and I fully expected to go into the army when one of my tutors stopped me in Tom Quad, if you know Christchurch, and said, would you like to do something other than going into the army? So I said, well, depends, might be interested. So he said, go and see the Master of Balliol, who was a very formidable figure. So I went to see the Master of Balliol, and he waved a German newspaper in front of me. He said, can you read the headlines? So I said, yes, I did. He said, do you do crosswords? I said, no. Do you play chess? I said, I haven't played chess since I was about 11. He said, well, you'll hear from us, perhaps. And the one progression after another. So I ended up at Bletchley Park.
And there's been so much in the news recently about Bletchley Park. I can see it, see you're rolling your eyes a little.
I am, because, do you want to get me going?
Yes, no, do. It's an interesting...
I'm the last survivor of a cryptographer who worked on the German High Command cipher, which was much more complicated than Enigma. Enigma had three or four rotors. This thing had 12. And it was a totally different system. And it was only used by Hitler and the German High Command. So I was part of the very small team then, working on this, which was... We broke a certain amount of quite a number of messages. At the back of the hut at Bletchley Park was a machine which was the, in a sense, the first computer known as the Heath Robinson, because it was always breaking down and doing funny things and flashing lights and so on. The more sophisticated version is at Bletchley Park in the Computing Museum part. And they were reconstructing the Heath Robinson. I don't know how far they've got with that. So that's where I ended up. But only for about large part of 1943. I then heard that there was some operation going on in, or something going on in London. I expressed interest in it. And through a long story, which is recorded in an article in one of the learned journals, which I won't bore you with now, I was transferred from Bletchley to Alford House on Park Lane. And the diplomatic and commercial section was down in London under a man called Denniston, whose two sons went to Westminster. I first of all was given the Finnish diplomatic thing to break, which I didn't, and nobody ever did, so that was all right. And then I was suddenly transferred into a highly secret thing, which was the Russian common turn cipher, which we broke. And those messages went straight, the decrypts went straight to Churchill, because that was the beginning of the Cold War. So that was between 1942 to 1945, when I went back to Oxford. That was my war, about 3.5 years of it. And I found it difficult to adjust after that, of course, to back in, well, one more story. I already had my bachelor's degree, and I said that my tutor was John Masterman, or one of my tutors. I said, I would like to do a B.Lit on the history of the Secret Service, because I'm sitting in the Bodleian, and I found all sorts of odd things, which I, you know, in those days you could get all sorts of things up about Elizabeth I's spy master and all the rest of it. So I said, I'd like to do a B.Lit on this. And he said, well, I don't think that's a good idea. He completely put me off, and I couldn't argue with him. And of course, I discovered years later that he'd written this book about his experiences of the war, the double cross system, whatever it was called. And he was determined to publish, which he did. And there's another story about that. When the book was published, the director of public prosecutions said to the attorney, I think we have to do something about this. Masterman has broken the law. He shouldn't have published what he did publish. So the attorney said, I better have a word with the Prime Minister about something of that kind. The Prime Minister was Hume. He said, prosecute Masterman? You couldn't, possibly. He was my tutor. End of story. But Masterman did put me off. Hugh Trevor Roper, who was another one of my tutors, wasn't interested in teaching. Well, these are characters not connected with Westminster particularly. Hugh Trevor Roper was actually writing, I think, The Last Days of Hitler. So he was much more interested in doing that. Occasionally he turned up in uniform, sort of ran off. So I survived. And I did any serious work at the Institute of Education in London and LSE, so all that is later.
Were you very frustrated, or have you been frustrated by the sort of focus on Enigma then at Bletchley Park? Do you think it's...
Yes, it got completely out of context.
Yeah.
Alan Turing, I met during the war, because he was working there, more or less next to mine. I met him after the war when he was, because I started my Home Office career in Manchester. He was at Manchester University. We had a very brief conversation. So I said, what are you doing now? And I knew his psychiatrist very well, Franz Greenberg. And he said, I'm working on the mathematics of plant growth. I didn't know plants had a mathematics of growth. So that was more the end of that conversation. Very strange character. He was a very brilliant man, obviously, but there were many other very brilliant men. And the whole thing has got completely out of focus, I'm afraid, with all due respect to what he did. But and now they've got a historian working there at last. But it's, oh, I don't know, being there and given talks and taking visitors and so forth. I think it's getting more on the right track. But there are a lot of things which are not, historically speaking, regarded properly. For instance, the contribution of the Poles. to the breaking of Enigma, actually. Did you know about that?
No, not properly, no. So, Polish intelligence?
A man called Rzeszowski, I think his name was. No, there was Tiltman and Denniston. Tiltman, brilliant cryptographer. They went off to, I think, to Poland, but the final meeting was somewhere in France, I think. And the Poles had broken, partially broken, into Enigma. So that was a great help to us when it really we needed to get down to it. But I hadn't otherwise much to do, nothing to do with Enigma. One didn't talk very much about Bletchley Park, about what anybody else was doing. There were one tour of Westminster's there, of course. That's where I met Angus Wilson on the training course, actually. Bentley Bridgewater eventually became Secretary of the British Museum. Various other people. There were not a lot of old, there were a small bunch of old Westminsters at Bletchley, but of a different generation, because they would have been 10 years older than me, mostly. So there is a slight Westminster connection there.
And then you had an, as you said, an odd adjustment to make going back to university after this.
Yes, if you've been away from doing research of a kind, but if you've been away for 3.5 years, it was difficult to adjust, and I didn't adjust particularly well, I don't think.
Was it an odd time at Oxford? Because there must have been a lot of people who had returned from military
yes,
service.
Yes, it wasn't a normal sort of intake, as it were, at that point. There was my generation, there was an even slightly younger group, including Edward Weil, who was a friend of mine, who became Minister of Education eventually. Those differences. I suppose the oldest person at an undergraduate level then would have been something like 28, 29, 30 years of age. It was a very odd sort of, it took some years, I think, to settle down, probably. But when I got to London University eventually, that was rather a different matter. The teaching was very much better.
And then throughout this time, did you always paint? Did you manage to keep up your...
Yes, I think I did, not during the war very easily. At Oxford, yes. Otherwise not. There were interruptions, obviously, throughout my whole career, but I tried to keep going. So, there we are. Did I send you a card with an abstract on it? So that's what I do now.
We're sitting in a room with one of your paintings that you painted in the immediate aftermath of the war.
1947, isn't it? On the back.
Of College, of the building we're sitting in. And I wondered if you could tell us a little bit about coming back to Westminster then, what made you want to come back and paint here?
I can't answer that question because I don't know what the answer is. I suppose I must have wandered in into Dean's Yard. I can't think what would have prompted me to do that at any rate. And I saw this building, which was a shell, and I thought, well, I did some drawings around about London, and I had some painting which was sold from Cork Street, of all places, and the owner of that particular gallery said, oh, well, if you'd like to do some more things of that kind, we were interested. But somehow my mind began to veer in different directions. So I didn't do much more. What prompted that particular visit, I don't know. Because when I had an office in the Home Office, just a few yards down the road from here, I called on John Carlton and said, can I come and see you? And I just had a chat, said I'm sort of working nearby. But otherwise, I didn't go back to the school. I went back to one commitment thing, which was all white tie and tails. That was in the Abbey, of course. Otherwise, I didn't go back to anything particularly.
Was it a shock seeing the state of the school's buildings?
Well, yes, I mean, but there was so much destruction round about in London. I mean, one took it as a matter of course, in a way, a sad matter of course. No, I think the thing that upset me most, after all, what was in college was not of particular historic interest. I think I'm right in saying it was the construction of the building, which I thought was red. It's actually Burlington, I think. So that, no, it was the up school, and that was the main loss, I think, as far as the school was concerned.
And then your art always remained as a sort of parallel strand, really, because you didn't ever become solely an artist, am I right
in saying? No, it started as a hobby. Much encouraged. It can date back to Westminster School with Wentworth Shields, undoubtedly. I think there was no doubt about that. And I just kept going on and off ever since. It was a hobby. It's now become, as it were, semi-professional. And I think I met Anthony Hepworth, who has some of my earlier work, including, well, that I found that I had, so I thought that might be of interest to the school. No, my main career, of course, has been finally head of research in the Home Office. So I'm a criminologist.
And then, just to finish off, really, the usual question that we ask at the end, is there anything you wanted to say or talk about that I haven't given you the opportunity to speak about?
I should probably think of that in the middle of the night. No, I don't think there's anything that I could possibly say. I think Westminster was a great experience, and I'm full of gratitude in many ways for my parents, who weren't all that well off, actually. Must have quite an expenditure, what with uniforms and all this, that and the other. So they made a sacrifice which helped me on my way.
Did you ever talk to them about that in later life after you left?
One doesn't with parents too. I don't know. Can we have that thing off for a moment?
Of course.